Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. The neighborhoods of Morningside, Mountain View, and The Bottom were the epicenter of Black Knoxville. Those three neighborhoods near downtown were robust, vibrant communities unto themselves, with schools, churches, businesses, and culture unique to the area and to the people who called them home. But beginning in the 1950s, property developers and local, state, and federal officials looked at Morningside, Mountain View, and The Bottom and saw instead a blighted area they felt would be improved by redevelopment. That was how urban renewal arrived in Knoxville. And over a 20-year period, the communities, businesses, social fabric, and culture were dismantled. The scars have still not healed. Beginning next week, WUOT News will air a series of reports that look at the economic, social, and emotional fallout of urban renewal in Knoxville. Today, we'll preview that series and discuss urban renewal. Later this hour, we're joined by the Reverend Renee Kessler, president of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center. But first, we're joined by a familiar voice, Heather Duncan, a WUOT News contributor who has been interviewing former residents of those neighborhoods and conducting archival research to put together the picture of urban renewal in Knoxville. Heather, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks. Hi, Brandon.
It's good to talk with you, and I know you've been working on this for the last few months here. Let's begin with kind of an overview, the footprint of urban renewal in Knoxville. What actually happened?
Well, as you said, urban renewal happened over the course of about 20 years in Knoxville, and it destroyed actually four neighborhoods. Today, we're going to focus primarily on the three Black neighborhoods closest to downtown that were affected. It started in The Bottom, which is what we now think of as the old city, and then moved Mountain View, which encompassed the area where the Coliseum and the Safety Center are now, as well as the hotel, which has changed hands many times since then, and other things up on the hill, and then spread east into Morningside and just kind of continued to roll along. It was hard to even tell where the edges of one project started and the next began because it was essentially continuous. Altogether, it covered at least 670 acres. It demolished more than 2,500 buildings and, of course, forced thousands of people to move. It also demolished 15 Black churches, which also had to move, as well as the entire Black business district, at least 107 businesses.
Well, you've mentioned... Go ahead.
Go
I was
going
to say that you've mentioned kind of in broad strokes what these neighborhoods were like, and you've talked to some of the people who actually lived there. What did they tell you those neighborhoods were like?
Sure. The neighborhoods were a real mix of different kinds of houses, Black-owned businesses. There were a lot of home-based businesses, as well as businesses that lined Vine Avenue, which is now part of Summit Hill and Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. The nature of the neighborhood was just very close and affectionate and felt like a family. Everyone starts off by saying how close the neighborhood was, how everyone knew each other, everyone looked after each other's kids. One example is I spoke with Emoja Abdul-Ahad, and his mother at one point had tuberculosis and had to be hospitalized for a while. And he lived with his grandmother some, and he lived with what he calls social aunts and uncles in the neighborhood who just kept him at their house at different times and looked after him. And a lot of times people had a hard time delineating who was actually in their family. There were people like Linda Freeman who told me that she used to just wander into neighbors' houses and eat a meal with them unannounced. If she just didn't like the food that her parents were serving for breakfast, she'd go next door and sit down and pull up a chair at the kitchen table. So it was very, very close. And people, although a lot of them say that in retrospect, they realize that by the standards of the day, they grew up poor, they didn't feel it at the time. They didn't have that sense as children. And they were very able to put things together and improvise with what they had. A great example is Brenda Green talking about sledding and making their own skateboards.
I was very adventurous. The kids in the neighborhood, we would take our skates and take them apart, and we'd get two pieces of wood, and then we would take and nail our skate on the front and the top part of the board, and then we'd get an old piece of rubber tire and cut it. That was supposed to be our brakes. Put a rope on it, and, oh, we'd have a good time riding up and down the hill. In the wintertime, we would go up the street because we had a great big old hill, and that was Pritchard Street. It was on the side of where Green Elementary School is at now, and we would go up there, and we would get five-gallon drum lids, and then some of us would get cardboard, and we would come off of Pritchard Street, came down, and hit Clint Street. Then it came on down, and then it hit Church Street. So we would always have somebody looking out, make sure no car was coming when we'd come down that hill. Oh, and we had a ball. We had a good time.
And you heard
there were a lot of people that told stories about grabbing hold of the back bumper of a car and skating behind it to you.
Oh, my gosh. And this also fits into, there was just this robust, this sense of vibrancy in these communities. There were businesses all along Vine Street, which if you look at a map today is only a fragment of what it used to be. As you said, Heather, most of this length has been turned now into the modern Summit Hill Drive and Martin Luther King. But Vine Street really was the epicenter of the Black business community at the time. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. There were all kinds of restaurants and pool halls, drugstores, Carter Roberts drugstore, everyone was in. There was a Black medical and dental building where Black doctors practiced because at the time they couldn't practice at the hospital. There were taxi stands because most people didn't own cars and either got around by public transportation or took a taxi home with their groceries. There were grocery stores. Geraldine Taylor gives a great sense here of the scope and scale of the businesses on Vine Street.
Oh, yes, indeed. Vine was loaded with businesses. At the very top of Vine Street were grocery stores owned by the Lowe's brothers. One was on the east corner, and the other one was on the west corner. And this is where we who lived in the project would go up and do our little shopping. Sometimes we'd go to Main Street, and that's where you did your big grocery shopping. But my mother would send us to the top of either of those hills to get little, like, meat or cabbage or potatoes or something like that. But up and down Vine Street, there was an ice cream shop there, Kay's Ice Cream. If I remember correctly, that little lady's name was Miss Mapp in there. And she'd give us a great big cone of ice cream, which only cost one nickel. There were beauty shops up and down Vine Street. There was a mortuary. There was taxi stand. There were, like I said, barber shops. That was, my dad was not the only barber shop. There were little novelty stores, a taxi cab stand. And there were pool halls. And you just name it. And everything that we wanted in the Black community was just about can be found on Vine Street.
Now, Ms. Taylor's father owned a barbershop that he opened on Vine and then later moved it to Central. And she says he was the first Black person to own a building on Central. He was able to eventually buy it from the owner that he had been renting from. And that business district was just a really hopping place that provided a great cultural gathering place for Black residents. Lots of people remember, especially the Gem Theater. Here's Elizabeth Johnson talking about something that she did down in the business district when she was a teenager.
After the Gem Theater kind of shut down a little bit, they turned it into a restaurant and nightclub. Once a month, he had the talent show for the teenagers. And me and my girlfriends decided we were going to be the Supremes. And we went down there and we sung. And this male group, never forget them, Donnie and the Lads, they won the talent show every time. And we were determined we were going to beat them. And we had to slip and dress there because we had on long evening gowns. So we would go down there and change into those, and we would be the Supremes.
There weren't a lot of good job options for a lot of African Americans at that time. There were a lot of low-paying jobs available and many that just weren't open to Blacks. But there were a lot of people in the neighborhood that worked multiple jobs or developed skills that gave them an itch and made them a role model in their community. Here's Robert Minter Jr. talking about his dad.
My dad was a cook. They call him chef now. One of the floors of the Andrew Johnson building was housed by the White Elks. They would have banquets there, and my dad was the head chef there. He did that part-time, but his main job was at the Laurel Room for Miller's. He also worked at Spike's Restaurant on Alcoa Highway. That was one of the jobs when he walked off from the Laurel Room because they had promised they was going to serve African Americans there, and he said they reneged on the promise, so he walked off the job, told them he wasn't coming back. And he ended up working at Highland Grill down in the Fort Sanders area. He did not own a car. My dad was so well known that he could stand on the corner and somebody would pick him up. But how he got to Alcoa Highway, a lot of the African Americans who worked at Alcoa Aluminum Company would drop him off on their way to work and pick him up on their way back. He was well known in the Knoxville area. He was also involved politically, too. He was ward chairman of the Park City area at Eastport, and he was poll watcher and all that.
And Heather, these stories are really flying in the face of the assumption that the planners of urban renewal said that these are blighted properties, these are slums, you know, we really could remake the face of this. I think one of the things you learned is those broad brush descriptions that were sort of the basis, the raison d'etre for the urban renewal projects, really weren't reflected in reality.
No, there were areas and individual houses that were in bad shape. In particular, there were folks who lived in the bottom that told me that the houses that were right along First Creek there were, very rickety. They didn't have indoor plumbing or electricity, and they flooded frequently when the creek flooded. But throughout the neighborhood, there were an array of houses and house types, including a number that look very similar to the kinds of Victorians and craftsman homes that you see in Fourth and Gill and some of our historic districts. There was the Gray Hotel. I talked to several people that lived in the Gray Hotel that their family owned. And it was essentially a home that just rented rooms to family members by the time urban renewal came. A neighbor of them was Linda Freeman, who lived in a former hospital. There were little buzzers outside all of the bedroom doors. I also talked to Jamesina Washington, who lived in a neighborhood that we haven't talked about, a Black section of the Yale Avenue area, which was a fourth urban renewal project that allowed the expansion of the University of Tennessee starting in 1962. Most of that neighborhood was white, but there was a Black section of it that was middle-class folks like firefighters, people that had teachers. Her grandfather had even built a driveway and a garage for their two cars, which tells you something for the time mm-hmm. period. And he collected slabs of marble and built a marble sidewalk in front of the house, which I don't know about you, but I don't know too many people that have a marble sidewalk in front of anything. You know, and many of these houses also had big yards that allowed people lots of space. Linda Freeman's house had a pond in the backyard that everyone came over and played at. There were a lot of people that raised chickens. Ms. Washington talked about how her grandmother had chickens and pheasants and turkeys, and they ate quite well. So these were many of them very fine properties to own and hand down in your family.
We're going to pause right here for a station break. We're going to pick up this thread in just a moment. You've been listening to Heather Duncan, a WUOT News freelance contributor, as we continue a discussion about urban renewal and its effects in Knoxville. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. But first, this is Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue now continues. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Our topic today, urban renewal and its manifold effects, particularly in Knoxville's black neighborhoods. Joining us right now is WUOT News contributor Heather Duncan, who's been researching this for a series of reports that will begin airing next week, Thursday, May 13th. We'll talk more about that a little later this hour. And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by the Reverend Renee Kessler, who is the president of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center. You can tweet questions to us at WUOTFM or submit questions on our Facebook post that we put up on facebook.com/WUOTFM. Heather, to continue our conversation, we have now described, in a very brief sense, what these neighborhoods were like: Morningside, Mountain View, and The Bottom, which is now part of the footprint of downtown Knoxville and areas immediately east of downtown, the James White Parkway, Coliseum area, The Vista, some of those areas that used to be very, very different than they are today. So let's get to that transition point. When urban renewal began to happen and federal dollars started coming in the city started making its plans, what did the residents that you spoke with remember? What did they feel like when these massive changes started coming to their neighborhoods, where now where you've lived and maybe where many generations of your family had lived was going to be something else, whether you liked it or not? You're out of here, you know, and this community began to fracture and be split apart by these outside forces. Well, what did people tell you they felt like?
Well, a lot of people felt pretty devastated. Let me add that I did close to 20 oral histories with folks who lived in these neighborhoods. I hope to continue to do more. And those are all going to be donated to the Beck Center when this project is finished this summer too, so that they will be available for people in the community who want to learn more to go and listen to the whole conversation that I had with a lot of these people, some of whom I talked with for more than an hour at a time. These folks were all children or teenagers, because enough time has passed that their parents and the people who would have been making the hard decisions about where to move and how to respond to this, we've already lost them. So what I heard from folks was the experience of a child or a teenager being uprooted for the most part. And it didn't feel good. Linda Freeman expresses it pretty well. She lived in the former hospital near the Coliseum. And here's what she had to say.
To me, it's a bunch of bull. Oh, we need to take your home and it's going to make it a better place. Did it? The Coliseum and the parking lot made it a better place. And you want to apologize? I mean, they took stuff from my heart. They didn't just take the house we lived in. They took all of my friends, all of my life. I mean, everything. You know, when they took that for a doggone Coliseum, and what do they have in? A circus. Is that more important than families?
That's powerful, Heather.
So people had to move. And on top of that, they saw all these institutions that they felt very strongly about and were very closely tied to destroyed. You had the YMCA and the YWCA that were for Blacks in town, both demolished. They were reopened in different places, but that was different. 15 Black churches, most of which were close enough that people could walk to them and often were there multiple times a week. There were elementary schools that were not directly demolished during urban renewal, but were sort of conveniently closed at about the same time. So people lost a lot. And even the streets changed, the street names, the streets that remained, they changed the names of. And so there were a lot of people that talked to me about how they felt like they'd been erased. And that was really difficult for them. And that now, even today, that it continues to give them a sense that they and the places that they care about are devalued, are not valued by the community of Knoxville. I talked to multiple people who live in the Park City area who have had offers made on their homes repeatedly. They're approached in their mailbox, by telephone, by real estate speculators that want to buy their property. Because some of these houses that they live in on the east side are 100 years old or close to that and are really historically and architecturally interesting. And they feel like this somehow implies that they need to get out of the way again, that what they have is too nice for them, that someone else should have it. So there are things happening today that continue to sort of open these wounds and that are perceived through the lens of their urban renewal experience.
Speaking of that, through the lens and kind of how these changes and what happened 50 years ago, we're still dealing with the fallout today. Faulkner famously said the past wasn't prologue, it isn't even past. People who think of urban renewal purely as history might be surprised to learn the changes that took place during that period are blamed today for many problems, including crime, poverty, access to health care, and other concerns. What did you hear about that?
That is definitely true. There were multiple people that talked about how the tragic gun violence that has taken the lives of 5 children in East Knoxville since the beginning of this year is related to the poverty that was created by the destruction of generational wealth during urban renewal. People didn't have homes and businesses anymore to hand down to their kids. It also destroyed these social networks. It broke up multi-generational households in some instances. People told me about growing up living with their grandparents and their cousins and uncles and aunts. And after urban renewal, some people went to live in public housing. Some people moved somewhere else. And once you get in public housing, there's limitations over your control over who lives there. So I think that Lavonna Moore explained this really well as far as connecting the dots between the loss of the home and what was possible for people afterward.
Homes were paid for, and they had redlined where you could buy property. Well, those homes, oh, they look good on the outside, but they're old enough where the plumbing is getting ready to go. The wiring is old. And they didn't give them enough money to pay for the home they had to move into, just enough for them to put a down payment, and it threw them in debt. And I'm quite sure that happened to most people that were uprooted. So they say, well, you know, when the Black people move in the neighborhood, the property goes down. That's the reason why the property goes down. They've been forced to go into debt. And then they can't afford to call in a plumber. That's money. They can't afford to have an electrician to come in and do new wiring. So yes, the property's going to go down because they can't afford to keep it up. It's not a good feeling. You lived in this home and you think, this is where I'll live till I die. Then someone comes and says, you got to leave. And besides, you got to leave, you're going to have to go in debt. But when you haven't prepared to go in debt and during the time when you're trying to send children to college, because my brother was still in high school, they couldn't help him go to college as they wanted to. And my baby sister, same thing.
Well, Heather, I understand, by the way, we are now joined by the Reverend Renee Kessler, President and CEO of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center. Reverend Kessler, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us. I know you're super busy, and I appreciate you carving out the time today. We are talking today, of course, about urban renewal and its manifold effects. Some people might be surprised in our audience to learn the Beck Center is a direct outgrowth of urban renewal. Would you tell us how urban renewal led to this cultural center, this official repository for Black history in East Tennessee?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for allowing me the privilege to be here. And I'm certainly grateful for this conversation, dialogue, discussion, and most importantly, for this work that's highlighting this important part of our history. So Beck was created as a result of urban renewal. In other words, once all of the devastation had happened, all of the homes had come down, the businesses had come down, the churches and schools, which I'm sure you guys have already talked a little bit about. Once what we call urban renewal had become sort of urban removal, had been dubbed that, the people began to get together and say, if we don't begin to preserve and conserve this history, this rich Black history, it's going to almost be as though the people in the places never existed. And so with that, the people began to meet and say, well, how do we begin to rebuild community? And I think that's a big part of urban renewal, is rebuilding community. It's about community. It's about people, the greatest asset you have in a community. And so these people began to get together. And at that time, the Beck House, Mr. James and Ethel Beck had transitioned, and the house was in the estate. The mayor at that time was Mayor Kyle Testament. Allowed the people to meet in the house along with the Public Housing Authority to begin to discuss what they wanted to see happen to their neighborhood now that urban renewal was on the other side of urban renewal. And so they began to talk about how they needed a place. They needed a community space and place to preserve and conserve this rich history for generations to come, so that no one will ever forget the stories that there was a great community in Knoxville and indeed in East Tennessee with rich roots. And absent of Beck having come together and began the Beck Cultural Exchange Center, we may never know the real devastation or destruction of urban renewal. So Beck is an outgrowth of that. The people brought all of their history, their books, their pictures, their paraphernalia, and everything from days gone by here to the Beck Center. And the people began to organize. And here in this house, which was the home of James and Ethel Beck, the third and final family to live in this house, the original mansion here at 1927 Dandridge Avenue. And so they were able to purchase the house out of the state with funds from Ms. Ethel Beck's estate. People who were closing out the colored orphanage, of which Ms. Ethel Beck was the president, donated the bulk of the money, $20,000, and then the remaining $2,500 came from city administration under Kyle Testament. So the people bought the house for $22,500 in 1975, named it the Beck Culture Exchange Center, and decided it was the place where Black history and culture will be preserved and conserved for generations to come throughout East Tennessee.
When you were growing up, Reverend Kessler, what did you learn about urban renewal? What were people telling you about urban renewal, and then how did that knowledge evolve as you grew older?
Well, first of all, I am a native Knoxvillian. I was born and raised in Knoxville, certainly not during the time of urban renewal. And so it had already happened by the time I'm coming of age and understanding it. And it's interesting because I didn't hear the word urban renewal. That wasn't what people would say. But they would always just say, it was very common to hear the government came in and took people's houses. I mean, they came in and took our community. That's what I remember hearing about how the government came in and took property. And specifically, I remember my stepfather owned real estate, some property, and his sisters and siblings. And I remember them saying, well, we better hold on to this as rental properties because the government's going to come back in and take the rest of this. I just remember hearing that. So there were lots, they began to buy up the property so that if they come this time, they're going to have to give us fair market prices. So it was almost just this conversation that I would hear, and I didn't know that that had anything to do with this idea of urban renewal. I just knew that Black people had been disenfranchised. People talked about it a lot, and it was always about the government and what the government did to the Black community. And so it's not until as an adult, I'm able to really begin come to the Beck Culture Exchange Center. Mr. Avon Rollins, who's one of my predecessors, began to share with me the rich history of urban renewal. And I began to understand it, and of course became a board member of Beck, wanted to get more intimately involved in it. And of course, ultimately will become a big part of this work that we're doing today. So, you know, I think it's one of those things that you don't necessarily know what it's called as you're coming up. You just know something happened and you hear the stories. And then as you begin more involved in the history of it, you get an awakening, if you will, about what really happened.
You raised an important point there, which is now that this the height of urban renewal is so far in our past now that we have generations of people in Knoxville that didn't grow up with it. They know James White Parkway, they know the Coliseum is there, and it's always been there for them, younger people. How do you explain the effects of urban renewal to the people who did not witness it and like you, maybe didn't know that there was a name for it? How do you explain what this really did to these communities that have been so radically visually altered?
Well, Obviously, the first way is I'm a visual learner. And I think sometimes before we can get into the nuts and bolts of what really happened is I have to give you a picture so that you can see it. That certainly was impactful to me to really go through the Beck archives and look at the houses, the homes, the churches, the businesses. And so Beck is doing what we're calling the Beck Cultural Corridor, where we are literally trying to put history back in its place with signage and technology so that you can see exactly where these places and spaces were and what the Black community looked like. Because from the beginning of time, certainly from the beginning of Knoxville's history in 1791, all the way through, you can see the building of a community. You can see the building of what we're going to be calling the urban renewal section. So prior to anything that happened in urban renewal, there was this amazing community. So I think the beginnings of understanding it is being able to see a picture of what was there. And that's what we try to do here at the Beck, is sort of recreate that history for you. So in pictures and in oral history stories that we tell, the people that you talk to, the people that you hear from, the people who are invested in Beck, so that you can hear their stories, you can hear, you can see pictures. Then we can dovetail and get deeper into, you know, the realities of the impact of urban renewal in terms of what happened. So what was there, so that you get a picture, first of all, from the very beginning. So when you say pre-urban renewal, I can't just take you to the 40s, right? Mm-hmm. Right before the 50s come and urban renewal is gonna tear everything down. I have to take you to the beginning of the history of Knoxville and enslavement and emancipation and all of those periods. So you can see the Jim Crow era. You can see how communities had to get built. You can see the disenfranchisement from that history. You can see, wow, a community was developed out of necessity, quite frankly, because think about it, we're in a segregated society. So if you need a grocery store, you're going to have to create a grocery store, mm-hmm. right? If you need a school, then you're going to have to create that. You're either going to have to do it, in your homes or in your spaces, or you're going to have to create your own school. So you need to understand that, first of all, how the community got built. What it looked like when it was a full, vibrant community that was in its heyday, and then what happened as it began to become dilapidated in some of the areas, and then when urban renewal took it over. So I think understanding all of that, and part of that is allowing us to kind of give you an aerial view of the area and then an up-close and personal look at each of those neighborhoods, those communities. And again, the most important asset, and I can't overstate this, is the people who lived there and built those communities.
That's the voice of Reverend Renee Kessler, the president of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center. We have also been hearing from Heather Duncan, a WUOT News contributor. We're going to continue our conversation about urban renewal in Knoxville in just a few moments. But first, this is Dialogue on WUOT. We're back with Dialogue on this Wednesday. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and our topic, if you're just joining us, is urban renewal and its effects and fallout in Knoxville then and today. I'm joined by the Reverend Renee Kessler, the president of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center, as well as WUOT News contributor Heather Duncan. A special series of reports based on Heather's interviews and oral histories with the residents of these neighborhoods will begin airing on WUOT on Thursday, May 13th. Reverend Kessler, I want to return to you for just a moment because these two things are united. We're here trying to tell a story. We want to tell a story, but we also want to get it right. This is an important and sensitive story that has a whole history attached to it. We can't just come in 5 minutes understand the story. How do we sensitively and respectfully learn about the experiences of people that have been uprooted by urban renewal, the lost sense of community, the lost culture, and do it right? How do we do that?
Right. I think that's a great question. And I think one of the most important things to understand is that urban renewal was not unique to Knoxville, right? Urban renewal is happening all over the country. And it's interesting because when you look at the history of Knoxville, it doesn't matter what period of time you look at throughout its history, something is also happening on the world stage, on the national stage. And so we just find out what does that look like in our neck of the woods, in our neighborhood. But it doesn't matter where you go in the country. When we talk about disenfranchising Black people, it is a subject that is universal across our nation. And so when we talk about it, we talk about it in respect of, yes, we know this happened here. There was urban renewal in Chicago. There was the race riots, you know, and over here, there was the race riots in Knoxville. They're all happening everywhere. So it's almost like same issue, different place. Mm-hmm. So how do we talk about it in a sense of, first of all, it's history. And history is truth. So the most important thing that we can ever do is tell truth. Because truth is what helps us to learn so that we can be better. And I'm appreciative of this story and what's happening now, because what we're trying to do is get at the truth. You can read history books and it can tell you what someone has written about what happened. Or you can talk to people who lived history and they can tell you sometimes the story won't be the same. And so it's important that as we do this important work, that we understand it's the truth that we want to know. We want to know it from as many authentic sources as we can. And we want to learn from it so we can be better. So when we talk about sensitivity, when we talk about how do we talk about this history, first we have to know it. We have to understand it. And when we do, we'll be better at how we are able to interpret it and learn from it.
How this leads me right into my next question, how the Beck Center is continuing its mission to help people understand during the pandemic, because the physical archives are closed right now, is my understanding. People can't go in the building, but you have a robust website and a YouTube channel. Would you tell us a little bit about that work?
Sure. Thank you so much. And so, yes, while our physical doors are closed, our virtual doors have remained open and have not closed since the health pandemic has gone in. But we also know, Brandon, that we have been in the middle of a racial pandemic, sort of a double whammy pandemic over the last year and a half, and we continue to find ourselves in the middle of this. I think it became very visible. Many of us can recognize a very defining moment with George Perry Floyd on May 25th in 2020, when he was knelt on his neck and he couldn't breathe and he was killed at the hands of law enforcement. So what we began to do is we began to look at racial justice issues. And specifically, we didn't say racial injustice, we said racial justice, because in history, and even with Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all of the names that we could call Ahmaud Arbery, when we look at that, we know what racial injustice looks like. When we look at history, we know what racial injustice looks like. In fact, we are in pursuit of racial justice. And I don't think you can ever get to racial justice until you understand historical racial injustice. And so as we have those dialogues, those conversations, it is important to us because we talk about all the time how history repeats itself, but when we know better, we can do better. Once we know history and we understand history, then we can begin to apply it to today. So many of our virtual conversations and discussions that we have held monthly since Juneteenth, June 19th, 2020, have been a way of allowing people to express themselves, have been a way of allowing people to dialogue, have been a way to open up history. Because I always say this, we understand that when we talk about Black history, urban renewal, and many of the folks that are in the history books that are marginalized communities, it's a very struggling history. And much of it's hard to read. It's hard to digest. And my hope is that we will learn some things so the next time we write the history books, it's not such a struggling history for marginalized people, specifically for Black people. And so I think that that what we're trying to do at Beck is to bring this history to you, because unfortunately, many of our students in schools don't get Black history. They barely get history in general. And we know that Black history is not included in American history, or much of us would know much of the history that happens in our country. So unfortunately, we still segregate history so we can make sure we get it all in. So many of the subjects are not in school anymore, but for sure, Black history is not there. So Beck becomes that for our school systems, K through 12. Beck becomes that for our collegiate students. We're partners with our universities, both Pellissippi, University of Tennessee, and all of our partners in universities around East Tennessee. We do discussions, we do conversations, we do lectures so that they can get this information. We have books that we produced here at the Beck with this rich history so that you get that. And then to your point, Brandon, we're also trying to put as much online as we can. I can also announce to you that we're in the process, even as we speak, of digitizing or cataloging our archive collection onto a platform that you'll be able to do real research online through. So that is through a grant to the IMLS, Information Museum Library Sciences, which is a federal grant we have specifically on urban renewal. So you will have that available to you. It's coming. Our hope is maybe by the early fall, we'll have enough of that online to open it up for people to start doing some research. But even if it's not finished, we'll open it up and we'll continue to add to it. So we have new software, we have new technology, and even more than that, we are putting history in the places and spaces where it happened. So even if you can't physically come to Beck, my hope is that you'll be able to pull up our internet or our website or an app, and you'll be able to go to the space. So for example, if you're standing at the corner of the Doggy Park, what we used to call Vine and Central, right there on the corner today is the Doggy Park, then you'll be able to use your technology, put it up to that space, and you'll see that that is the place where the Gym Theater was, which is our Black theater, where many Black folks had to go because at that time they can't go to the Tennessee Theater on Gay Street, nor can they go and sit down in the first floor balcony of the Bijou Theater. They would have to go to the second balcony in a different entryway in order to go to the movies in downtown Knoxville. So understanding that you can go to those spaces and places, to me, that's where you can really connect with history. And so Beck is trying its very best to not only create a space where people, families, tourists, individuals can go and learn about the history and the places where it took place, but also so that whether we're in COVID or we're out of COVID, there's still outdoor spaces where you and your family can visit and learn about this rich history.
And I just want to direct our listeners, by the way, to that. The website is beckcenter.net. That's all one word, beckcenter.net. And you can also search for the Beck Cultural Exchange Center on YouTube to see these town hall meetings, which are typically an hour or more in length and have very in-depth discussions on those videos. And you can watch them, of course, at your own pace. I want to ask you, Reverend Kessler, as well. If somebody hears this discussion today or is going to be listening to the news reports that will begin airing next week on WUOT and wants to share their story or donate photos, documents, correspondence, anything like that, is that possible? Could they do that?
Thank you so much, Brandon. Absolutely. In fact, everything that we have in our archive studio, in our research lab, are donations from the community that people have donated. Houses that have been turned over or flipped or whatever, they find old things, they bring them. You can do that Tuesday through Friday here at the Beck Center from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. So you can just stop by. If you want to bring a donation, you can email us online. If you want to make a donation, there's a contact form. You can call us, 865-524-8461. So we take them every single day. So other than Monday, we're closed right now on Saturday, Sundays, and Mondays, but Tuesday through Friday, we have someone at the front desk from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we also have access online if you'd like to email us and let us know. And if you're not sure if it's something Beck will take, don't guess, just bring it and we'll figure it out. But somebody needs to research that information, and it's important. And Brandon, while we're on the subject, because you're going to be listening to these amazing stories as you go throughout the week, and I'm grateful for the work, I want to say that right now we are in the middle of about to embark upon, it looks like a baseball stadium downtown, and it's going to be on the footprint where the first urban renewal projects. So one of three projects that really displaced and disenfranchised the African-American community, the Willowwood, which many of us call the bottom when we talk about history, because people who live there will call that area the bottom. And people have asked me, Renee, what do you think about the baseball stadium? What do you think about this development coming here? And I want to say this, the problem with urban renewal was displacement of people, disenfranchisement. Where the baseball stadium is going, that was the original part of the bottom. That was a part of a huge African-American community. And you can see it's laid in ruins all of these years. And so I am grateful. I am beyond grateful to now see development happen there. So I'm grateful for Randy Boyd and for the Gym Development Corporation and all of the folks who are investing in that property. We need investment in our community. My hope and my desire and my belief is that African-American people will get a chance to do it better this time, that the community can be involved in the project, that the community will have an opportunity to create economic impact in this community, and that the community will be a very real part of it, so that we're not displacing people, so that we're not putting people out, we're not taking property, but somehow we're now giving back to this community through economic development, through job creation, through all the things that they have said this project will do. And I am excited about that. As a native Knoxvillian, born and raised less than a mile from there, and right now still live in the same house I grew up in when I was 8 years old in Park Ridge on Woodbine Avenue, I am excited and thrilled that I work, I preach, I pray, and I go to eat and have a great time riding my bike, all within a mile radius of where I live. And I want my whole community to have that same experience. And so I am excited about the opportunity, perhaps, to do it right this time. And so whenever you do anything, the first priority is the people, the greatest asset. And so I am very encouraged that our people will have an opportunity to be a very real part of this. And we're excited, for Beck's point of view, to be able to put Black history and culture back in that space, on that field, so we can tell the stories of what used to be there and be a very prominent part of it.
Thank you, Reverend Kessler, for that. I want to bring Heather Duncan back into the conversation for a moment. On this, Heather, just to, as we're getting close to the end of the hour here, to remind listeners that this is a series of stories that will begin airing next week, May 13th. And if you would, give us kind of a brief overview. What will we be hearing first on May 13th?
On May 13th, we'll be hearing sort of an overview story that introduces what urban renewal was, what the thought process was behind it, at least the stated thought process, and then what the actual effect was. We'll get kind of a sense of how much of the community was affected and how those effects did continue to have impacts on those families for generations afterward. So it's kind of your 360-degree view.
Okay, a good place to start. And again, Heather, these are the stories that we'll be hearing will be based on and drawn from the interviews and research that you've done with many of people who were then young, who lived through urban renewal and are sharing their stories and their memories with you now. Copies of those interviews are going to be donated to the Beck Center later this summer.
That's right. There was also a lot of research in archives, and I looked at old newspapers and reports that were done by the city and as well as regional organizations about housing and about urban renewal in our city. Knoxville was very active in urban renewal, even compared with other cities of its size in the region. And it tended to impact Black people even more than at the national level. Nationally, about 60% of the people that were forced to move by urban renewal were Black. In Knoxville, it was 70%. So it had a very broad impact that is measurable in a lot of places. And I'd like to give a shout out as well to Brianna Flanagan and Janine Winfrey at the Beck Center, because they helped me with some of my research, as well as Nkeshi El-Amin, who is a local sociologist. She also founded a nonprofit called The Bottom that encourages Black creatives and is a great space that she's trying to make permanent there to do both creative work and justice work. And she wrote a tremendous dissertation whenever she was at UT that was a wonderful source for me. And she pointed me in a lot of good directions. So I want to thank her, because she has really done a lot of looking at how urban renewal affects the Black community into today and its sense of place and what and belonging or lack of belonging. And okay, that's part of what we're hoping this series will do, is help us look at ways to do things, as Reverend Kessler said, differently in the future, so that we can create a sense that everyone in our community belongs in our community.
That's the voice of Heather Duncan, WUOT News contributor. Her reports begin airing on Thursday, May 13th, a week from tomorrow. We've also been hearing from the Reverend Renee Kessler, president of the Beck Cultural Exchange Center. Thank you both so much for being with us today. I sincerely appreciate the conversation. And indeed, thank you. And you've been listening to Dialogue, a production of WUOT News. And Greg Hill is our producer. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, wishing you a good day from Knoxville.